I'm about to move to Burwood in about 5 months from now. And one of the things I'm most excited about is living close to all the different restaurants and cafes on Burwood Road. You see, on it, you've got Lebanese food, you've got Chinese food, you've got Vietnamese food, you've got pub food, and you even have Asian food. And this entire strip between St. Paul's all the way to Burwood Park is a snapshot of multicultural Australia. In fact, our city, not just Burwood, but Sydney of City of Sydney in general, is so diverse that parts of our city looks like other parts of the world. For example, I have a couple of friends who went on a holiday without me. We're no longer friends anymore. You can understand why. But they went on a holiday without me, and when they got back, I asked them, "Hey guys, how was your trip?" They went to Hong Kong, and I said, "How was Hong Kong? Was it worth it? I've never been before." And I said, "How was it?" And they said, "Oh, dude, don't bother going." And I said, "Why? Why is that?" I'm like, "Dude, that's like Yum Cha. There's all this awesome stuff." I said, "Dude, Hong Kong's like Hurstville, but just cheaper. That's all." You see, this is Sydney. We go to Leichhardt, you see different cultures. You go to Burwood, you see different cultures. The city of Sydney is a melting pot of cultures. Because of that, it is difficult to go to school, to go to work, to go to different leisure activities without coming across people of different cultures and ethnicities. This is what makes our city so exciting. And it's fascinating, right? Because every different culture has their own traditions. See, take Chinese culture, for example. We have a bunch of cultures that people think are crazy. And many of you know what I'm talking about because you see, how do you know if a house or an apartment belongs to an Asian family? You look for the shoes outside of the door, right? Another one that's been a bit more pressing for me in a lead up to me and my fiance's wedding is this question people always ask us. Are you going to have a tea ceremony? Now, if you're like me, then you're probably thinking, "Oh, look, what are tea ceremonies for anyway?" You're probably thinking, "Look, this is irrelevant, inappropriate, outdated for our time." But because I kept getting asked these questions, part of me just really, really wanted to find out the reason behind why these traditions exist. And I'm going to be honest with you, right? Once I found out, I thought that these reasons were pretty genius, right? So, tea ceremony, for example. I'm not sure if you know much about it. You're probably married, and you probably had one. You probably had older siblings, and you were part of pouring tea and all that kind of stuff. But it's not just because older people are thirsty and they want tea to drink. You see, historically, tea ceremonies were designed as an opportunity for the newlywed to show respect to the parents, to the older people. That's why you bow down on knees and you kneel in front of them. But tea ceremonies are also an opportunity to signify a changed relationship between the couple and the parents, because you see now the newlywed, the daughter and the son are considered a daughter and a son to both parents now. And that's pretty significant. And it's also opportunity to give parents an opportunity to welcome the newlyweds into their respective families. And if you know much about Chinese culture, you know that this is pretty huge because it is huge to accept a man or a woman into the family who's not part of the bloodline and to say, "Look, now you're one of us. I'm going to call you son. I'm going to call you daughter." It's pretty incredible. And this whole ceremony is meant to be a step towards that. Plus, the sweetness of the tea is meant to symbolize the sweetness of the relationship between the bride and the groom. Isn't that nice? You see, once you come to understand it, the tradition becomes quite meaningful. Now, that's a simple example, but we have other more significant ones. But you know, many people today continue various sorts of traditions, whether it's cultural, whether it is social, without really knowing the reason or the purpose behind them. In fact, many will even condemn those who don't follow these things. They'll say you're wrong. They'll say that there's a problem with you. Now, traditions aren't bad. In fact, many times traditions are good. They're created for good reasons. But you know, my friends, it is entirely possible to follow a set of traditions while missing the heart or the point of the tradition. It's entirely possible to follow a set of traditions while missing the heart or the point of the tradition. And this is the scene and the situation that we're in right now in Mark 7. If you have your own Bibles with me, then I'd like to invite you to mark out or highlight these words: defiled, unwashed, ceremonial cleansing, and tradition of the elders, because these words show us that the situation that we're dealing with right here is concerned about traditions, about cleanliness. But this is not a sort of physical cleanliness. It's not like Jesus' disciples were a bunch of toddlers that needed to be reminded to wash their hands before they eat. No, we see from verse 3 that this is a type of ceremonial or ritualistic washing, which means that a type of uncleanliness being dealt with here is not physical hygiene, but spiritual hygiene. Now, to understand the significance of this, I want you to zoom back into history with me for a moment to understand why the Jews were absolutely meticulous about their cleanliness rituals. You see, in the Old Testament, we read that the priests were required to wash themselves before they entered into the tabernacle because the God that they served is a holy and awesome God. Now, this is similar to cleaning up or scrubbing ourselves up before we meet someone important. It's like putting on our best suit or our best outfit before we meet a CEO for an interview. It's like putting on our best dress before we go on a nice date. You see, we adjust our outward appearances to match the occasion. You know, today Muslims do the same thing before they pray, and Jews continue certain cleanliness rituals as well. In fact, Muslims, for example, have a saying. It goes like this. They say, cleanliness is the half of faith. Cleanliness is the half of faith. So they go through ritual washings, they put on clean clothes before they present themselves to God in prayer. In essence, these outward actions of washing up are meant to mirror the inward holiness of the person, because only holy people can approach a holy God. We see, my friends, we move on a little bit and we see that this wasn't just for priests, because the book of Exodus also tells us that God's plan was for the whole of Israel to be a holy nation, and that God desires for every Israelite to be part of his holy people. Now, I'm not sure what comes to your mind when you think about holiness, right? The word might make you think of a blinding bright light in the sky or angels with halos over their heads. But while Hollywood may want us to think of holiness as something that is supernatural, saint-like, or virtually unattainable, the biblical concept of holiness is basically set-apartness. Holiness is set-apartness. And so to say that something or someone is holy is to say that that thing or that person is special. They're set apart. They're distinct. Now, that is why we can say that God is holy, because he is completely different to us. He is creator, we are creation, and because of that, we can say that God is special. He is set apart. He is distinct. But to say that God's people are to be holy is not to say that we are like God. No, it is to say that we are special, set apart, and distinct from those around us. You see, holiness is like a flower among thorns. In the midst of prickly and unpleasant thorns, the beauty of a lily or a rose is amplified because of how distinct and how beautiful that flower is. And so Israel is meant to be a holy nation and a holy people in amongst people who don't worship the true God. Which is why if we fast forward once more, we'll come to a time when different sects or different denominations of Jewish groups will form. And these groups were formed because of the different views on holiness and cleanliness laws. And one of the most prominent groups among these is the Pharisees, whom we confront today. And we know from archaeological and written evidences that Pharisees had large lists of rituals that the members had to obey, and they were absolutely strict and uptight about them. They had laws that dictated how they spent their time, laws that dictated how they spent their money, laws about how they should purify themselves. And what we see in your Bibles in verse 4 is just a little fraction of that. So why are there so many rules? I want you to lean in real close for a moment, because you see, the tradition of the elders were not just about physical and spiritual purity. They were also about social purity. They weren't just about physical and spiritual purity. They were also about social purity as well. Because you see, Jewish law dictated that you could be defiled by coming in contact with things like dead bodies, human feces, and other contaminations of sorts. But you know, we understand that today, right? We in Australia, we get that. We understand these things are dirty. That's why we keep dead bodies and human waste on the ground, so we never have to deal with them. But you know, in Jewish culture, defilement could also come from contact with different types or different classes of people. Defilement could come from coming in contact with different types or different classes of people. Which is why we read in our passage that the people who come from the marketplace, underline that if you want, they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. Now, why marketplace? Is that because business people are dirty? No, because you see, the marketplace is where different types of people come together. It is a bit like the George Street or the Pitt Street or the Martin Place in our CBD, where different types of people come together. This is the marketplace is where the poor, the unhealthy, where the social outcasts, they all came together and they rubbed shoulders together. And Jewish law states that contact with these types of people would make a person unclean or unholy. Now, we don't see this as explicitly in our culture or our context, but this is very evident. For example, in the Indian caste system, you see at the very top, you have the Brahmins, right? These are the academics. These are the priests. And at the very bottom, you have the untouchables. These are the people who are the street cleaners or the toilet cleaners. And people in these distinct caste systems never come in contact with one another because that would make them socially unclean. So we need to see that the issue of cleanliness that we're dealing with here is not merely spiritual, but also had a social dimension to that as well, which is why the Jewish leaders were absolutely strict about people obeying these laws. In fact, you could be cast out from their groups if you fail to obey their laws. Because of this, we need to see that this is a sort of self-righteousness that comes from being better than somebody else by race, by socioeconomic status, or by piety. It is a kind of I am better than you attitude based on who I am and what I do. But you know, we don't have to travel to India or back in time to Jerusalem to observe the very same thing. Because you see, we too respect the men and women who have the corner offices. And we look down on those who work in the basement. We prefer to rub shoulders with the wealthy. And we prefer to keep a safe distance from the socially awkward. Don't we do that? So we gravitate to people who are a bit more like us. We smile when a beautiful person asks us for the time. But we shrink back when a homeless person smiles at us. We willingly stand up and offer our seats to people whom we deem respectable. Yet we stay seated when we feel that like this person doesn't even deserve to be in the meeting room. We envy the cousin who studies at a prestigious university or works at a global company, and we look down on those whom we think are less educated. You see, we hang out with people who look like us, who work the same job as us, who wear the same clothes as us, and we do this all the time. And so the Jewish leader's problem is also our problem. And so they ask Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders? And this is very interesting because it reveals so much about what's going on in their hearts. Because you see, their question was not, why don't your disciples live according to God's laws or the Holy Scriptures? But instead, they ask, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders, the traditions of people? You see what's going on here? The Pharisees knew that God wanted his people to be holy. But rather than achieving holiness by God's way, they decided to create their own traditions to justify themselves and to become holy according to their own ways. Once again, instead of becoming clean according to God's ways, the Jewish leaders want to become clean according to their way. Which is why Jesus says here is that the Jewish leaders have missed the point. Now, Jesus is not saying that traditions are bad per se. Instead, he says that traditions have become bad when we decide to honor the traditions instead of honoring the God for whom these traditions were made in the first place. You see, I'm about to enter some controversial grounds for a moment to illustrate a point, right? But this kind of attitude is a little bit similar to our attitude towards preaching, okay? You see, since the Reformation, Protestant Christians around the world have placed a significant emphasis on the preaching of the word. That's why, you know, that's elevated. It's important. Preaching is important, right? We here at Grace Point absolutely uphold that. Which is why we strive to ensure that we have quality and faithful preaching every week. But because of this, I think some churches are in danger of making preaching the center point instead of making Christ whom we preach the center point. It is entirely possible to do that, to think about the craft of preaching, the art of preaching, yet in the process lose sight of whom we're preaching or the message that we're preaching. Many churches will say, yes, we believe that Jesus is absolutely important. But it's so easy to make that peripheral, isn't it? To think about how we can be much more engaging and forget the God whom we are worshiping. You see, my friends, it is easy to uphold tradition and forget the meaning or significance of that tradition. But a side application for us here is to, yes, keep preaching, but to keep making Christ our ultimate goal. But to come back to this issue of tradition of elders for a moment, what we have here is people upholding the tradition of holiness rather than upholding holiness itself. We have people here upholding the traditions of holiness rather than holiness itself. Jesus is saying, you have missed the point. Which is why Jesus calls them hypocrites, frauds, or pretenders. And nobody likes hypocrites. We especially dislike hypocritical leaders, which is part of the reason why a faction of the military in Turkey raised a coup against the government just yesterday. We also dislike hypocritical teachers who tell us to do one thing and they themselves do something else. We dislike hypocritical bosses who take advantage of all our work. Here, Jesus calls these Jewish leaders hypocrites because they say they honor God. They say they worship Him, yet their hearts are far away and instead they follow human rules. Then Jesus illustrates His point here by drawing out an example that may seem a little unfamiliar to us to begin with. You see, in verses 9 to 13, we see Jesus drawing a comparison between God's command and human tradition. He says, on one hand, God's command is that we should honor our father and mother. On the other hand, the Jews had a practice called korban, which means that whatever is classified as korban, this thing right here, is devoted and set aside for God. See, in today's term, korban is kind of like a vow or a deferred offering. It's also similar to like legal wills. So if I say all my savings here are korban, I'm saying that all my money is set aside for God and cannot be used for anything else. Now you see, that seems harmless and godly enough, you know, just oh yeah, all my money is set aside for God. But the problem with korban is that it is only an express intention of giving rather than actual giving. So you can see how we can have a problem. God tells people, you need to honor your father and mother. But instead, they've gone ahead, they've used God's name to set money aside so they don't have to spend that on taking care of their parents. They say, that's God's money. I can't use it on you, mom and dad. In doing so, they put that aside so they can use it for themselves. So here we see people twisting God's word, twisting perhaps even good practices for their own greed, for their own intentions, for their own pride. I remember someone told me a story once of a very wealthy old man telling his son, he was dying on his deathbed. He said, son, I want you to bury me with all my money when I die. And his son replied, really? All of it? You're not going to leave anything for me? And the father said, yes, every single cent. I want you to withdraw everything from my bank account, sell all my property, sell all my stock, sell all my real estate, and I want you to bury all of that with me when I pass away. So the time came and this man's father passed away. It was a very sad occasion and many were there to witness the funeral. Then the time came for the son to bury all of his father's wealth. So people walked away to give the young man a bit of space. And after a few minutes, the young man walked back to his friends to join the crowd. Then one of his friends asked, did you really listen to your father's instructions? The son said, yes, of course. And his friend said, but your father had over $1 billion worth of assets and cash. Did you really put all of that in his coffin before he was lowered? The son said, yes. They said to the young man, did you really bury everything with your father? And the young man said, of course I did. That's my father's wishes. I buried every single cent with him. And everyone around them was shocked and said, wow, this is a really good and pious son. So they asked him, how did you do it? How did you do it? And Hassan said, easy. I just wrote him a personal check that he can withdraw whenever he's ready. Nobody gets it, and that's okay. You see, this is similar to Korban, right? Dad is dead. He can't withdraw it. Come on, everyone, laugh a little bit, right? You see, it has the facade of honoring God, yet buried deep inside is selfishness, greed, and disobedience against God. And Jesus says here that this is their attitude towards tradition of the elders. Rather than relying on God for their holiness, they've created their own laws to earn their holiness. Rather than being made clean by God, they've made laws to clean themselves. You see, the Talmud, which is a collection of Jewish laws and traditions, says that the words of the scribes are more lovely than the words of the law. The words of the scribes are more lovely than the words of the law, which translates as, the words of the Jewish leaders are more lovely than the words of God. See, once again, it is easy, right, for us to say, oh yeah, these Jewish leaders, man, they were way off the mark. How dumb, you know, they were absolutely wrong. How silly could they be? But the moment we say that is the very moment that we are doing the exact same thing. Because you see, without Christ, all of us create ways to clean ourselves or to make ourselves holy. We all feel a sense of uncleanliness or unholiness within us, which is why we feel like we're never good enough. You see, our desire for external cleanliness is a reflection of what we want inside. This is why high schoolers do whatever they can to clean themselves. They use cans and cans of deodorant to make themselves more acceptable to the opposite gender. It's why we feel better about ourselves when we play the game of comparison. It's crazy. You know we won't be as clever as our manager, but in comparison to the guy at HR, man, I am definitely much more well-educated, much more well-groomed, and much more well-mannered. We know that we'll never be as good-looking as our older sibling, but in comparison to our younger sibling, my goodness, I look good. You see, our desire to clean ourselves and then become holy is also the reason why we work so hard to prove ourselves. Because for many of us, our work is where we get our sense of worth and approval. We clock long hours, not necessarily because we enjoy it, but because we want to be known as the guy or girl who works hard. We want to be that person, not purely because we need to, but because we enjoy the applause that comes from being efficient, that comes from being effective. You think about it, like what do you want to be known for? We work for that. Here's an interesting and perplexing one. I'm guilty of this one in particular, right? You know, they say that people who are richer and more well-off are the ones looking down on those who are less well-off, right? We always have that perception. But did you know that people who are less well-off can also do and say things that makes us feel superior to those who are wealthier than we are? See, the opposite is true. We'll say, oh yeah, look at all those rich people traveling the world. Oh my gosh, it's so bad. Seriously. People in different parts of the world are starving and you're wasting money to travel the world. No, we'll say, oh, look at those guys buying a new investment property. Oh, seriously, those guys are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. I tell you, man, rich people are the worst. You see, we can feel better than those who have much. And all of these, my friends, are forms of self-salvation because we are either doing stuff or denying ourselves of certain stuff to make us feel morally superior to other people. But you see, my friends, is the problem with this is that you can never win. You can never make yourselves clean. You can never make yourselves holy. Which is why Jesus follows on with the punchline. He says this: it is not what goes in the person that defiles them, but what comes out. In other words, it is not what you do on the outside that makes you clean, but what happens on the inside. And this is huge because Jesus shows that the solution to our problem, he does this by pointing to the failure of our works, but also by revealing that defilement can only be cleaned by something more than external rituals, more than external washings. Because the truth is, any desire to clean ourselves is like running on a treadmill. No matter how fast or how hard you run, you always end up on the same spot. And the only way that we can overchange positions on a treadmill is if we fall off and crush our face. Because you see, any attempt to clean ourselves will either be disappointing or they'll be crushing.
You see, the truth about the Pharisaic laws is that you can never keep up with all of them. Just when you think, oh man, I've got it, I'm keeping these laws, I'm doing well, there are hundreds of other laws you violated in the process of keeping that. And it's the same with us. Clothes come in and out of fashion. Diamond, gold, they depreciate. Our age catches up so that no amount of makeup can hide the reality of our maturity. And we know that telecommunication companies have, you know, the scheme to make sure that we're buying new gadgets every 2-3 years, keeping us hungry. Things come, things go. And Pokemon Go will die out. You see, we can never win. Self-justification and self-cleaning will never work. It's like drinking water from an ocean. The more you drink, the more you thirst. It gives you the impression that things are going in, but it's really starving you out. Our self-salvation cannot clean us of our defilement any more than can a spider web stop a falling rock. It is absolutely impossible. Which is why Jesus says this. He says, don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into the heart, but into the stomach, then out of the body. In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, what comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it's from within, out of a person's heart, that comes that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. And oh my, this changes everything. Right? Here Jesus is saying, it's not what you do that makes you clean. It is who you are that makes you unclean. And you know, this explains so much about the human condition. Because Jesus says here, nothing you do can ever make you clean because the problem is not outside of you. The problem is within you. See, from this we can see that our healing is not from avoiding some sort of infection that is outside of us. Healing can only come from radical spiritual surgery to change our very core. And this is what Jesus has come to do because he is our solution. You see, rather than telling us to maintain our traditions and practices, Jesus came into history to fulfill all of God's commands, to live the holy life and to pay the price for our unholiness so that when God sees us, he sees us as holy people. He fixes our heart, our very core, so that what springs out of us can be holiness, can be purity, can be cleanliness. Jesus frees us from our unending and perpetual futile pursuit of cleaning ourselves and instead comes to clean us. He comes to perform that radical spiritual heart surgery so that we no longer have to live to prove our worth or to feel better about ourselves by comparing ourselves to other people. He came to replace our hearts of stone with a heart of flesh that is alive, that is active, that is beating, that is sensitive. You know what's fascinating, right? If you look at verse 21, you see that it says, out of a man's heart or out of people's heart comes all this list of sins. And we could effectively say here that sin is a misalignment of the heart. And Christ has come to liberate us and tune our hearts to the right beat. You see, the Christian faith is the only faith that says that God himself has come into earth among humanity to secure our holiness on the cross and has risen to life so that we can be right with God. And when that happens, it doesn't matter what people think of us because the only one's opinion who really matters already approves of us. It doesn't matter what we look like because we know that we are made in the image of God and he has bought us with the precious blood of his son. It doesn't matter what part of Sydney you live in because for those who belong to God, we know that he has a place for us in eternity. It doesn't matter or not we are in a romantic relationship because it is in God that we find the truest pleasures that can be found in any sort of relationship at all. And it's from this that we can find true liberty from disappointment, true liberty from devastation, because holiness is no longer about who I am, but about who God is. We don't have to be perfect, because who you are is not dependent on what university you went to, what job position you hold, what title you have, how good you look. You see, my job doesn't need to bring me all the joy and satisfaction, because my status is not in how much money I make. is not where my work takes me in the world. You see, what we could not do, Christ does for us, and that is the beauty of the gospel, isn't it? This is what we preach week in and week out. But my friends, here's another thing. Christ has not only secured our holiness, he has also called us to live holy lives. And I'm afraid this is often our blind spot in the church. And I want to end this evening's sermon with this, right? Because at this point, you might be saying, wait a minute, didn't you say that we don't have to do anything because God has made us clean, God has made us holy? Yes, absolutely, that's true. God did secure our holiness for us, but you know what? God still desires for us to live as holy people. See, his desire for Israel to be a holy people is also his desire for us, the church, to be a holy people. So just as Israel was meant to live as a holy nation amongst unholy neighbors, so we too, the church, need to be a gathering of holy people in a world that is actively rebelling against God. And we see this all over the place. So while how we live does not make us more holy, God desires for us to live as a holy people for at least three reasons. And let me invite you to write this down, please, because this is going to change your life. Because here's the thing, right? Holiness glorifies God. It's simple as that. You see, holiness is not a passive pursuit. It is not something that we sit back and just become. Holiness is something that we can pursue. See, Christians need to live lives in such a way that shows that our God is big, that shows that our God is great, that shows that our God is awesome, shows that he is the Lord of our lives. In other words, our holy lives brings God delight. He sees that and that makes him happy. See, we do the same for people we love, right? Whether it is a spouse, a parent, a child, a boyfriend, or a girlfriend, we do things for them, not in order that they will love us more, but because we know that doing this or that will make them even happier. You see, we give our boyfriends or girlfriends surprises, not because they'll love us less if we don't, but because we know that that will bring them great joy. We spend time with our parents, not because we need to, but because we want to. We love seeing the joy on their faces when we hug and kiss them, even though they're pushing us away. Oh, no, don't do that. No, we know they love it. We know they're having a good time, and we love doing that for them because it makes them happy. It makes us happy. In the same way, nothing we do will change God's love for us because he loves us infinitely. He loves us more than a mother, a father, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a husband, or a wife, or child can ever love us. Yet at the same time, he also wants us to live in holiness so that our lives are consistent with our profession, so that our works are consistent with our words. Our holy lives brings God to light. He sees it and he says, I love it. I love it. Second of all, holiness is a powerful gospel witness. Holiness is a powerful gospel witness. And you know what? This is another way that holiness glorifies God. Because in a time of rapid social and moral decay, our fight against the evils listed in verse 21 makes the gospel shine like a blinding light piercing through a cold and dark world. You see, when we do that, when we rid ourselves of arrogance, of envy, of deceit, of malice, that is when we begin to make a statement to the world to show that the gospel changes everything. You see, people often ask, right, you know, how do we evangelize to a world that no longer wants to hear the gospel? And I say, this is it. This is it. Live lives that are consistent with your testimony. See, for example, you may work in industries where arrogance, envy, deceit, and malice are actually not just encouraged, they might even be rewarded. But a white lie is not going to hurt anyone. Stepping on other people to get the promotion is part of the game, they say. Lying about our taxes means more money in our pockets. And you know what? Blowing our own trumpet, making much of ourselves, can bring about greater career advancement. Yet in the face of all of this, my friends, God calls us to be holy, to be set apart. You see, my friends, if Christians and churches began to take God at his word and pursue holy lives, that everyone around us will see that this is a mighty God who demands the attention of his people, who desire to proclaim God's power with their lips and with their lives. This is not a God who's just an add-on to their shelf of different beliefs and worldviews. No, this is a God that changes everything about these people. But thirdly, holiness brings wholeness. Holiness brings wholeness. And this is an important one to note because we need to remember that being holy actually makes us more human. Holiness makes us more human. Think about it for a moment, right? God didn't give us commandments and rules to suppress our joy. Instead, He has given all of these things to maximize our joy. You know, many skeptics will say, I can't believe in Christianity because there are just too many rules, they say. But the assumption behind this statement is that rules and boundaries are bad for us. But my friends, true freedom is not the absence of restrictions, but it is instead the presence of the right restrictions. And health fanatics know exactly what I'm talking about, right? You know that you cannot just eat whatever you want. We have to restrict certain freedoms like junk food in order to experience the richer freedom of a healthier life. We have to restrict certain freedoms and ride that bike or run that extra mile or do that extra set of deadlifts in order to experience the deeper freedom of a longer life. My fiance wakes up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to the gym. That's wrong. But she's healthier than I am. And you know what? Musicians understand this as well, right? They give up certain freedoms in order to practice so they can better perform and express themselves musically. Aaron Imperial isn't that good on the guitar just overnight. He's practiced. He's worked hard. And that benefits us. You see, my friends, pursuing holiness is the same as pursuing wholeness. You see, it is when we abstain from sexual immorality, adultery, and lewdness that we can find true delight in our relationships. This is what God has designed for us. It is when we learn to respect one another's property and learn to restrain ourselves that we can live in harmony. It is when we put aside greed and live generously that we can begin to prioritize other things in our lives, like our families, like our spiritual life. It's when we put aside malice and slander and instead pursue love and reconciliation that we can enjoy deeper, more profound, more fruitful, more wonderful relationships. It's when we put aside envy, arrogance, and folly that we can stop drinking the toxic that damages our soul and begin to learn to celebrate one another's victory and humbly accept correction. See, my friends, God's call for our holiness is not arbitrary, it's not random. It is so that we can make Him look great, but also so that we can be more like who we were designed to be. My goodness, will the world begin to look so different and reflect the glory of the one and only Son when the church begins to shine like a bright light, a beacon of holiness? See, people will begin to see how we live and say, I want some of that, because my friends, we are meant to live like a flower among thorns, which is why 1 Peter chapter 2 verse 9 says, but you are a chosen race, a holy priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His wonderful light. They see the way we live and they live a counter lifestyle, and part of them is going to say, hey, that group right here, there's something right going on right there. And I want some of that. Imagine the kind of glory that would bring to God when people see your works and they see your words, they hear your words and they say, I want some of that. So my friends, only Jesus can cleanse us. I want us to remember that. Only Jesus can cleanse us. But since He has done that for us, He tells us to live holy lives for His glory. He tells us to live holy lives to declare the greatness of the gospel. And He tells us to pursue holy lives because holiness brings wholeness in life. Why don't you join with me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we thank You that we do not have to work hard at cleaning ourselves to be holy in Your sight. We thank You that You were defiled for our sake so that we can be made clean. And we thank You that Your blood has washed us of all of our uncleanliness. So we pray, Lord, that we would live in humble obedience and submission to Your word. We thank You that You've replaced our heart of stone with a heart of flesh so that we can live holy lives for You. So seal these truths into our lives and help us as we continue to pursue these things. In Jesus' name we ask and pray. Amen.